University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers to the campus to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Dr. Don Trauger, a scientist with the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee, and his lecture, United States Energy Resources, Are We Rich or Poor? A 1942 graduate of Nebraska Wesleyan, Trauger has been involved in the development of nuclear weapons and energy for more than 50 years. As a graduate student at Columbia University, he joined the Manhattan Project just days after it was formed in 1942 to work on the development of nuclear weapons. When the Manhattan Project ended in 1946, Trauger joined the staff of the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. In 1958, then-Senator John F. Kennedy called Oak Ridge one of the world's leading centers for research in classical nuclear physics and chemistry. At Oak Ridge, Trauger worked in a variety of positions on the development of nuclear energy for both military and non-military uses. Trauger, who served as senior staff assistant to the director of Oak Ridge from 1984 to 1993, officially retired in January 1993, but continues to serve as a consultant to the laboratory. He received honorary Doctor of Science degrees from Nebraska Wesleyan in 1973 and Tennessee Wesleyan College in 1977, and is listed in Who's Who in America, Who's Who in Engineering, and American Men and Women of Science. A native of Exeter, Nebraska, Trauger graduated from Exeter High School in 1936. Join us now for University Forum and Don Trauger.
Thank you, Dr. Weierbein. Energy resources, are we rich or poor? The availability and use of energy has been a major factor in shaping the world's nations and in determining their status. Fortunately, the United States has been blessed with a multitude of energy resources. Their use has contributed to our outstanding progress, indeed, to our having become a nation of leadership and power. In reaching this plateau, we have used the resources that were easiest to recover. None have been totally depleted, except perhaps the virgin forests. The impact of depletion of the first of our national energy resources may depend on the perspective of the lumberman or of the owl. Our future prosperity will depend on how we conserve and deploy the remaining resources. The potential is great. The task is not easy. We can be either rich or poor. Today we'll consider our indigenous energy resources and the possibilities to extend them through effective use and conservation measures. The resources fall into three broad classes: fossil, renewables, and nuclear. Now, while my life work has been with nuclear energy, it's not my intent to overemphasize its importance. However, it is interesting to note that all of our energy derives from nuclear sources. The sun is a nuclear source that has given us fossil fuels from the past and biomass and direct heat from the present, Geothermal energy derives from radioactive decay deep within the earth. And we generate some electricity with nuclear power plants today. Now let's look at a bit of history. We recently made a very pleasant journey on a ship on the Russian waterway, the Volga. The palaces of the Tsars were dazzling in their beauty and magnificent in size. The busy Volga, much of which has been modified for commerce, is a tribute to man's ability to shape nature to his needs. However, it was distressing to note that much of what had impressed us had been built by slave labor, the energy of slaves. Now, it was a renewable energy resource. Slavery was largely eliminated in the 19th century by humanitarian movements enabled by the development of improved energy systems. Better use of animal power and the perfection of steam made the feeding and carrying of slaves uneconomical. We must bear in mind that the state of the technology and the accompanying economy will always be a factor in determining our energy choices. Thus, energy and its effective use are very complex subjects. They involve the environment, natural resources, our social and economic structure, and the dedication of the government and the people. Obviously, energy utilization must change as resources are depleted, as we better understand the environment, and as new technology is developed. Orderly transitions from one energy source to another may take a lot of time. Hence, in considering our energy resources, we must include time as an important factor. We will explore our energy sources in the aforementioned commonly accepted categories: fossil, renewables, and nuclear. Two elements of time will enter, importantly. First is the years that the scarce sources will last at projected rates of use, and the second, the future period in which we responsibly should concern ourselves in planning for better energy utilization. With respect to time, our economic system tends to be impatient. Corporate investors want to see a return in the next quarter. Our elected representatives may look only to the next election, 2 years away. The president looks to 4 years, or optimistically, to 8. Now let's see how time is viewed by one energy industry. The National Petroleum Council conducted a comprehensive study of the United States reserves of natural gas last year. Their study reports that we have 65 years of gas supply at present rates of extraction, and that we should feel free to increase our use of this resource. Now look at 65 years for essentially depleting a major energy resource. It may be a short time. I note that Dr. Jensen, who was my college mentor and later a good friend, was a student here in 1905. Between Dr. Jensen and me, we span approximately 100 years of time and most of the history of this college. Suppose we think in terms of my grandchildren or the students, for students, your children, people in whom we surely must have an interest. When I read the National Petroleum Council report, I thought, my granddaughters should not be forced to burn coal to stay warm or to be cold in their later years. So suppose we think in terms of 50 to 100 years this morning. Many factors must be considered in evaluating the status of our country's energy resources. How much energy will we need to sustain our people? How many people will there be? What responsibility should we assume for future generations? What capabilities should we ascribe to them for creating new energy sources? These issues would require much more time than this allotted hour. In fact, it might well be the subject of a 3-hour credit course. I understand students get some credit for this, but I doubt you'll get 3 hours credit for this particular lecture. In order of utilization today, energy resources are fossil fuels, nuclear electric, solar, hydroelectric, and nothing else of much consequence. For the future, geothermal and biomass have good potential. The latter may be of special interest to agricultural states such as Nebraska. Energy conservation is economical, attractive for the short term. In a sense, it also is infinite, for once conservation measures are built into the society, it continues indefinitely. Conservation, however, cannot replace an energy resource that has been totally depleted. How are we doing today with respect to our energy resources? USA is not in a comfortable position. Our greatest uses are from the smallest resources. Present reserves of oil are projected to last about a dozen years. Now, we perhaps shouldn't panic because projections 10 years ago were not much longer. On the other hand, drilling of wells has extended the proven reserves, and importation of oil has increased, and that's left us in a workable position. But the amount of oil found per foot of drilling has declined steadily over recent decades. The major North Slope development in Alaska extended our oil reserve by approximately 3 years. The wilderness area is probably somewhat comparable. The seriousness of our oil supply is demonstrated by the creation of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. The Department of Energy is directed to store large quantities of oil in caverns that were created by the extraction of salt from formations in southern states. The reserve is to cushion the impact of interruptions of foreign oil supply, has both military and civilian application. The present reserve is estimated at an emergency level of use to last 137 days. Now, what are the prospects for finding more oil by drilling within our country? Slant drilling to follow geological formations and chemical and pressure treatment are relatively new and effective, but both are limited. The country has been quite thoroughly explored. I was personally responsible for the proposed radioactive waste repository planned for an abandoned salt mine in Kansas. The site proved impractical because a number of uncharted drill wells were discovered in the vicinity. However, in the investigation, we observed that 40,000 holes, exploratory holes, had been drilled in the state of Kansas alone by 1970. Larger oil-producing states have had even more drilling. So it's very unlikely that we will discover major additional oil resources in this country. Now, we have important oil resources available in tar sands and in oil shale. The recovery of the oil from the tar can be accomplished by heating the formation to reduce the viscosity of the tar so that it will flow somewhat like oil. This requires large amounts of energy. Burning the tar to produce the heat would be uneconomical. A study indicates that perhaps the only practical way to provide that much heat would be with nuclear energy. Considerable study of the oil shale has been done since early explorers found that when they took the wood away from a wood fire that they had protected by certain rocks in the area, that the rocks continued to burn. Unfortunately, if the oil shale is brought to the surface and heated in retorts to obtain the oil, you obtain a very undesirable environmental residue. If it's very difficult also to recover the oil from the shale in heated underground retorts. It's much more difficult than it appears to be from the tar sands. Now, we also can convert coal to oil with the addition of hydrogen, but there the immediate products are carcinogenic. So it's a difficult process too. Today, over 50% of our oil is imported. And by the year 2000, it's projected that it will be more than 70%. This represents a substantial balance of payments problem that's costly in other ways. We recently fought a war with Iraq. It was at least partially motivated to protect oil supplies for us, for Europe, and Japan. Perhaps more important in the long term is the leverage that the petroleum countries can exert, the OPEC countries can exert, on our choices of energy supply. This can occur through their control of oil prices, or as in 1973, by the interruption of supply. Now, returning to natural gas resources, in the well-researched report by the National Petroleum Council, they assume that advanced methods for recovery from various geological sources will prove successful. However, since council members sell natural gas, it may be assumed that theirs is not a highly conservative estimate. In fact, the studies by the Office of Technology Assessment of the U.S. Congress and by the National Gas Institute project reserves of approximately 50 years. Now, both the Bush and Clinton administrations have favored greater use of natural gas, even for stationary power plants. It has very attractive qualities, and the industry can presently supply more gas than is required, although at certain peak times that's not so clear. Should the rate of gas use be increased because the industry has an excess capacity to supply it? Well, of course not. But gas, for example, when burned, does produce less greenhouse and other environmentally objectionable effluents than does coal. And thus, there may be valid reasons for increasing natural gas use in the short term. But those increases should be limited in time, quantity, and application. Natural gas should be used for home heating, for industry, industrial applications, and for chemical extraction of chemicals, rather than burned in stationary electric generating plants. Now let's consider coal, a plentiful fossil fuel. Its reserves are estimated to last for 600 years or more at the present rate of use. Since the use is declining, it may be even longer. How then should we view the inherent problem of the greenhouse gas generation in the burning of coal? The carbon dioxide that's a major product from burning of coal creates the greenhouse effect. Those who claim that the effect is not proven may be correct, but the principle on which the effect is based is valid. The uncertainty lies in how much CO2 will be utilized by biomass and how much the oceans can absorb. However, the greenhouse problem, once shown to be severe, is very difficult to reverse or eliminate. Conservative position should be to assume an unfavorable impact for several reasons. First, changes in atmospheric conditions, which the greenhouse effect would produce, can bring drastic effects, as was demonstrated by the recent torrential Midwest rainfall, even today. Other concerns are for acid rain, other atmospheric pollutants, and the environmental effects of mining. The major coal resources reside in western states, such as Wyoming and Montana, that are far from the industrial centers and from major markets. It also has a low energy content per unit weight. Thus, transportation energy use are high. Today, we burn precious oil in railroad locomotives to transport the coal. Thus, the greenhouse effect and the logistics of using coal stand as deterrents to its increased use. To make a point, the more drastic greenhouse warming projections portray Nebraska as becoming a desert. There perhaps were recent rainy days when that may have looked attractive, but I remember the devastating drought of the 1930s. In the remainder of this lecture, it is assumed that greatly increased use of coal is to be restricted in the United States. Now, although we're addressing U.S. energy resources, there are some international aspects that are important, particularly for developing countries. Many parts of Africa and Asia use biomass, but they do not on a self-sustaining basis, and often with accompanying adverse environmental effects, even to creating deserts and serious flood conditions. Fossil fuels, although not widely indigenous there, would be convenient for their use in their societies at their present state of development. If there's to be a limit on the total use of fossil fuels, such areas should have priority. Presumably, developed countries can handle more sophisticated systems. The world's major oil and gas reserves are in the Middle East, a politically unstable area. Remembering that economics may be controlling in the introduction and use of new energy resources, we must consider the control that the OPEC organization can wield. The cost of extracting oil from many of the reserves is much less than the price. Thus, the OPEC can control the cost of oil at a price just below that of any new oil resource that we might develop. There are no easy solutions, particularly when the world picture is included. Now, how are we addressing the problems of fossil energy use and conservation today? Following the oil crisis of 1973, auto mileage was improved, insulation was added to new homes and remodeled homes, and more recently, the recycle of energy-intensive materials has been introduced. However, we seem to have reached a plateau, and not much more is happening. Increasing the gasoline tax is resisted, even though it would encourage better auto mileage, carpooling, and needed public transportation. I was attracted by a recent cartoon by Danziger in the Christian Science Monitor. It showed men standing beside a large tree. One was saying, "Don't tax you, don't tax me, tax that fellow behind the tree." Behind the tree was a baby in a bassinet. It was a commentary on our deficit spending and and our leaving that problem to future generations. We seem to be doing the same thing with respect to improving our energy situation. Furthermore, the government's financial deficit constrains national research and development, and industrial development of new energy sources is lagging. Now let's turn to renewable energy sources and first consider hydroelectric, since that is now in use. We probably have essentially exploited this source to near its maximum potential. The environmental factors such as flooding of land that could produce biomass and recreational needs are considered. The potential for additional exploitation is rather small. Thus, we'll not give hydro further consideration in this discussion, except to note that the dams are quite permanent. They probably will be replaced at the end of life because of the ecological damage to the impoundment, and which in most cases renders the land unsuitable for other uses. Now, biomass is a solar energy system. It's of particular interest in agricultural states. I note the price differential for gasoline and gasohol as an incentive to use a local biomass product. However, the methods used for its production at the present time require approximately as much or perhaps a little more energy than the energy that's added by the methanol that's put in the gasoline. So it's not a solution to the problem. The potential for biomass lies in the development of plantations for the production of rapidly growing trees or grasses. This also requires the refinement of chemical processes and energy conversion systems. Now, at present, biomass is used in the U.S. in the form of steam for processing materials for electricity to run factories. These units are fueled with byproducts from the fabrication of wood products, sugar cane, and other waste products. The basic energy material is essentially free. There's no established biomass industry to produce large quantities of energy. Many questions would have to be answered. First, how much land could be devoted to the plantations that would be required? What would be the environmental impact of large areas of new crops? Also, more efficient energy conversion would be required for biomass to be economical. Conversion of biomass to liquid or gaseous fuels is attractive but expensive. Biomass may best be used as fuel for boilers. Thus, our question of the time frame for the introduction of new systems comes to the fore. To put this question into perspective, the Office of Technology Assessment has estimated that it would require one half of the arable land of the country to replace our domestic oil use. It could take a long time to put into place the infrastructure for biomass to produce even a significant fraction of our energy supply. This should not be a deterrent, but reality must be recognized. Also, biomass should not displace food production when much of the world is hungry. Solar energy also is used in the form of wind. As a landlubber boy, I was fascinated by ships with sails. The sail rigged to my coaster wagon, unfortunately, led to several disastrous trips to the roadside ditch. Although later on, money for college was earned by repairing farmers' windmills. They were afraid to climb the tower and paid me well. However, although this was a lucrative endeavor, it may have left me with a negative feeling toward wind power. Even so, the large windmills on the coastal hills of California produce a significant amount of energy there. Windmills in the mountains of North Carolina and the Northeast have not fared so well. Ice storms and ice and wind storms are deterrents in much of the region in which prevailing winds would be suitable. Even so, the potential for wind energy to contribute to our long-term needs at competitive prices is somewhat attractive. Now, more directive applications of solar energy lie in in the heating of homes by judicious placement of windows and by heat-absorbing walls and solar collectors for heating water. The use of these techniques has more potential than Americans thus far have employed. Seemingly, this is in favor of architectural attractiveness and the convenience of the thermostat. Direct conversion of sunlight to electricity is a clean and attractive system. There may even be some solar calculators in the room. The technology is now practical for relatively small, portable, or remote applications. Development of thin film converters that increase the energy efficiency and can be mass-produced seem to offer competitive prices a decade or so ahead. Here again, the potential seems greatest for dispersed units of modest size, that is, small compared to modern fossil or nuclear units. A 1,000-megawatt electric plant, the size of our large plants, would require about 300 acres of collectors. If the collecting area was contiguous, the handling of rainfall would be a substantial problem. If the units were spread out to accommodate maintenance, which would certainly be required, they might cover a square mile or more, and that would present even greater environmental problems. The installation on commercial and industrial building roofs or on suitable land areas does seem attractive. The match of solar electric to air conditioning demand is excellent, but sunshine is part-time, and it doesn't match up well with the evening peak load. Its electricity can be stored in superconducting coils, it can be stored in batteries, or in flywheels. But the cost estimates suggest that the cost of storing the energy in any of these ways is likely to be much too great, and accordingly, solar energy will be practical only with a standby energy system that can pick up the load when several days of rain occur. Now, geothermal energy is an intriguing and potentially large energy source. Thus far, it's been exploited commercially only where natural springs of hot water or steam occur. These are quite limited, but hot rock occurs widely in our western states. Experimentation and demonstration units suggest that this may become a substantial source of electrical energy. To extract the heat from the hot rock, it's necessary to drill to the formation, fracture the rock, drill a second well in the affected area, and then pump water down into the hot rock and up to extract the heat. The drilling, since the geothermal temperatures are low compared to those for efficient steam electric plants, special equipment must be used. Contamination of the recycled water with minerals and the resulting corrosion present additional concerns, as well as geological effects of extracting large amounts of heat from the rock formation. Drilling costs for hard rock also need to be reduced. The hot rock in the eastern U.S. lies too deep for the process to be economical, so the transmission of electricity would need to be increased from the west to the east. Coupling of heat in a different application, the coupling of heat pumps, such as we use in our homes, to shallow wells, so that the well would provide a heat source in winter and a heat sink in the summer, is a very practical way to improve our energy efficiency. But the cost is high, and thus far we continue to use air-to-air heat exchangers. Now turning to nuclear energy. It produces about 21% of the U.S. electrical energy supply. That's equivalent to 8% of our total energy needs. This compares with oil at 41%, natural gas at 24%, coal at 23%, hydroelectric at 3%, and all other renewables at less than 1%. Indigenous supplies of uranium are estimated to last for 40 years at the present rate of consumption in light water reactors without the use of recovered nuclear weapons materials. When uranium is used in breeder reactors, the effective supply has increased 60 times. Thus, the extent of resources is not limiting in the time frame that we have chosen. Social and political concerns, however, over safety and radioactive waste now restrict further deployment of nuclear plants. Great strides have been taken by the industry and utility companies in cooperation with the Electric Power Research Institute to improve the safety, operating effectiveness, and cost of the light water reactors. Their expectation is that they will improve the public acceptance and be able to proceed with new nuclear plants. I personally believe that these reactors will be efficient and good neighbors. Even so, I prefer the high-temperature gas-cooled reactor because its safety is assured by its design, which is based on the inherent properties of nature rather than on engineered devices by man. It also will produce more electricity from the uranium and produces less waste heat. Nuclear waste is now a non-technological problem. Past practices used in military nuclear waste disposal have been replaced by technologies to assure that the waste will not injure people or the environment. The degree of protection greatly exceeds that of most industrial practices. Even so, investors' political perceptions continue to be negative for nuclear energy. Fusion energy, in principle, offers inexhaustible energy supply. This incentive drives a large effort in the United States and other developed countries. At this point, however, fusion has not reached a stage corresponding to that of fission in 1942. It is an extremely difficult technology from which to design a power plant to extract the energy and to make a practical source of supply. Note that it has taken 50 years for fission energy to reach 8% of our energy supply with an easier technology that in which the concept of power plants existed in 1942 that do not exist for fusion today. Thus, I place this exciting but more difficult technology beyond our time frame. On the other hand, energy conservation is both quick and effective in alleviating energy supply problems. Obviously, if less energy is needed, the supply is relatively greater, and our energy wealth is improved. In the 1970s, we shifted from a supply-oriented system to a more balanced program between supply and effective energy utilization. Research conducted or sponsored by the Oak Ridge National Laboratory has improved household furnace efficiencies from a 25 to 50% range to 85 to 95%. And similar improvements have been made in many appliances and industrial equipment, particularly as is testified by manufacturers' labels that boast about what they've achieved, much of which was done in your national laboratories. Similar improvements have been made in other, enthusiasts such as Amory Lovins provide a service in proposing a very wide range of energy conservation measures that could provide great reductions in energy demand, particularly in industry. However, it often is not economically practical to replace buildings, appliances, and industrial equipment before their normal end of life. So we have another reality to look at. Now, both government and industry should maintain a national dedication to energy conservation. Recycling of materials is directly beneficial to energy conservation. Unfortunately, conservation can only achieve a minimum energy use. Whatever that is, it must be multiplied by the number of people that must be served. The population is expected to grow for the next several decades. Thus, more energy will be needed. Now, finally, we address the question, are we rich or poor in energy resources? Obviously, if the time frame is a few years, we're rich, except in oil. If the time frame is longer, the status is determined by our dedication to the options just discussed. Business as usual without increased use of coal must lead to energy deprivation in no more than half of our time frame of 100 years. Since the economy has generally followed energy use, this would not bode well for college students in their later years. As we look ahead, perhaps for 50 years, let's assume that the convenient systems for distribution and use of electricity, gas, and oil remain somewhat as they are employed today. That is, transmission lines and pipelines, the infrastructure is in place. There may be provision needed for electric vehicles. I haven't really touched on that. But we assume here that the present oil and gas supplies will at least be restricted. The options for generating electricity, if coal is no longer acceptable, are geothermal, biomass, direct solar, and nuclear. A geothermal is difficult to estimate since experience is limited and it's geographically constrained. It may require more than 50 years for extensive deployment, but its potential is really great. Biomass will be limited by the land areas that can be freed from other uses and perhaps by environmental constraints. It may be most needed for costly conversion to gas or liquid fuel. Direct solar panels should be used extensively in dispersed installations placed on buildings and other suitable areas, but it must be coupled with another energy source. Wind may be a small but useful contributor. Where then does nuclear energy stand in the overall picture? Some view nuclear as a source of last resort, despite its advanced state of development in the United States, Europe, and Japan. Present nuclear plants are operating well here and in other places. And in France, they produce 70% of the total electric power generation. Nuclear energy could readily fill the U.S. electric power needs of the mid-2000 period and beyond from the standpoint of ore resources, cost, and the requirements for waste disposal. I hope that you've been convinced that oil is our immediate problem. Since land vehicle transportation is the major user, its appetite must be curtailed. Europe and Japan reduce oil use and derive revenue by a high tax on gasoline. Noting Americans' aversion to taxes, and perhaps particularly that of Nebraskans, I recall a story by the city's namesake and now run the risk of traveling out of Lincoln on a fence rail. Since the price of oil can be controlled by international organizations, taxation seems to be the only sure mechanism to minimize resource depletion. Now, in budget discussions this summer, dire predictions for the economy were made concerning a 4.3% increase in gasoline tax. Now, remember that in the 1970s, gasoline prices increased by a factor of four, from 30 cents a gallon to $1.20. Some stress was felt, but the economy did not collapse, even with that increase, and with an accompanying increase in other energy system costs comparable to that for the oil, which were not affected by the oil, but the industry managed to take advantage of the situation. Thus, modest tax increases would encourage better vehicle mileage and less costly choices, such as improved public transportation. The revenue should be used to develop needed technology for new oil sources and for the developments to improve our supplies of electricity and gas. Any excess revenue could be used toward eliminating the government deficit and reducing the national debt, both of which are long-term constraints to achieving needed improvements in energy resources. Such measures would place our country in a better position to confront new crises which are sure to come. I recall the 1940 lectures of Dr. Rosentrater here at Nebraska Wesleyan, in which he envisioned many of the U.S. problems of the past two or three decades. He also predicted that more economic stress will become evident in the next century as competition from far eastern nations intensifies and resources are depleted. He was indeed a visionary man. Obviously, predictions extending to 50 years are speculative, perhaps even foolhardy. To project further to 100 years is even more difficult. But people have given very little attention to either. Perhaps a better understanding of the nature, the complexity, and seriousness of our energy supply problems would be achieved if such thinking could be undertaken. Planning for the long term, however uncertain, could only help. Such planning is surely needed for the United States to continue to be rich. A more informed public is also a vital need. It may well be that a 3-hour required course in energy technology in all of our universities would better assure the future. Thank you.
Today's University Forum speaker was Dr. Don Trauger, a scientist from the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee. His lecture was entitled, United States Energy Resources, Are We Rich or Poor? This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is an independent, coeducational undergraduate liberal arts institution, nationally recognized for excellence in teaching and the high caliber of its students and faculty. Approximately 1,400 full-time students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.